Good day, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the new changes to Rule 76 conference call. I would like to introduce Serena Sutt. Please go ahead.
Hi, everybody, and welcome. I would just like to say thank you all for joining in today. We have a lot of fun things to talk about, and to start, I would like to introduce Mr. Rick O'Coin, the speaker of our conference today. Rick is a partner at Beard Winter with a wide range of litigation experience before all courts and tribunals. The focus of his practice is civil litigation with an emphasis on property, casualty, tort, and negligence cases, commercial insurance, product liability, and coverage issues. Rick's practice also focuses on professional errors with an appointment to the preferred counsel list for the defense of lawyers in their professional capacity. Rick has been providing litigation services along with risk analysis to a large number of provincial, national, and international insurers for in excess of two decades. He has represented clients at numerous trials, pretrial conferences, and mediations. In addition, he involves himself extensively in consulting and presenting to his clients on a variety of issues of interest for the purposes of continuing education and keeping his clients informed. Rick approaches all aspects of his practice with exceptional interpersonal skills. He is among the leaders in building value into his professional services by working to secure the best result while being attentive to the time and expense considerations of his clients. Rick is a past elected management committee member of Beard Winter, a past articling principal, and more recently, he became the head of the insurance department for the firm. Without further ado, over to you, Rick.
Thanks very much, Serena. Good afternoon, everybody, and thanks for joining us today. I know it's the lunch hour, so I'm going to try my best to do this as quickly as possible. It is a procedural change, so it's not like we have a lot of case law or anything to review. It's really about what to expect. There's a bit of a history here that I'd like to go through first, just to start. But before I do that, just in terms of my perspective on this, you should understand that I am an insurance tort litigator, so I'm coming from that background to discuss the changes that are coming up on January 1st. This Rule 76 has been around for quite a lengthy period of time. I'm not going to go way back, but go back as far as 2010 when we had some changes and probably had similar conversations like we're going to have today about the effect of the changes. But back then, it was really just about the number. It moved from $25,000 to $100,000. And back then, a lot of people considered whether or not this was going to move a number of the bodily injury claims into the simplified rules. My experience over that timeline, I mean, that's 9 years ago, is that I haven't really seen it been used. There's been the very odd claim that came in under the simplified rules. But otherwise, I found that the plaintiff's lawyers had proceeded essentially as they had before, suing for millions of dollars, even on claims that were ultimately dismissed or had very small results at a verdict. So we'll come back to that a little bit. So I think it's on that history. I mean, it was underutilized from that change from $25,000 to $100,000. And I think that this is a part of the process of getting into a change in the rules to see if that process can be utilized on a more fulsome basis. So to the last year or so or more, we've had these consultations and eventually discussions about what was going to be occurring in the change. My understanding is that the individuals who are involved in these changes consulted with many stakeholders, insurance companies, plaintiff's lawyers, groups involved in various types of litigation to get their two cents as to these changes and to have everyone to be on board because there are some substantial changes. I think from the court's perspective, it probably has a little to do with what they're seeing from the bench on smaller cases, both in terms of the verdicts with juries and also the cost consequences, which is a concern on the insurance end. So ultimately, we have the regulation 344-19, which will be in play as of January 1st, 2020. I should mention, I'll send a very quick discussion paper along with the actual regulation following this discussion today, so you can see exactly how it is worded. I'm going to talk primarily about the simplified rules, although there is a change in relation to the small claims court jurisdiction from $25,000 to $35,000. So you'll see claims that reach in within that world being brought into the small claims court. But as I said, I'm going to focus on the simplified procedure, which is the more significant change for the purposes of this regulation. So the most obvious one is that there is a monetary jurisdiction change, just like we had back in 2010. In 2010, it was quadrupled. In 2019 or 2020, it's going to be doubled from $100,000 to $200,000. We'll get a little more into the procedure. I'm going to break this down into the pretrial phase, the trial phase, and but part of this regulation also speaks to limiting costs, both in terms of fees and disbursements that everyone needs to be aware of. So assuming you are tending to a claim within that monetary jurisdiction, the costs are limited to $50,000, which is not an insignificant amount, but probably insignificant compared to some of the cost decisions that we've seen where plaintiff's lawyers or plaintiffs have been successful in getting a very nominal verdict and getting cost awards that are leaps and bounds beyond the actual amount that was awarded by the jury for various reasons that I won't get into. So the fees component of $50,000 is the limitation. And then disbursements, which sort of ties in with the experts that we'll talk about in a moment, is limited to $25,000. This is excluding HST. Those limits don't apply to an action under the simplified rules commenced prior to January 1st, 2020. So probably I would think the most significant change under this regulation to Rule 76 is the jury trial and the lack of being able to proceed in front of a jury within the simplified rules for actions that are commenced after January 1st or from January 1st onwards. I think that was a large part of the process of getting it to the point where we are going to have this law as of January 1st, 2020. That was taking away a very substantial right to parties, and that was a reason for the consultations amongst the various stakeholders. But jury trials will no longer be available under the simplified rules. There is an exception to that. I don't know how many of us that are on this phone call would be involved in these types of claims. But if a claim is for less than $200,000 but arises for allegations of slander, libel, malicious arrest, malicious prosecution, or false imprisonment, the claim will proceed under the ordinary procedure and jury trial will be available. So that's the exceptions. For the majority of the practice that I have in the motor vehicle or commercial general liability, those types of claims, jury trials will no longer be available under the simplified rules if brought within that monetary jurisdiction. Getting to, again, a little bit more of the procedure, under the former simplified rules, we had a limitation as it related to examinations for discovery. It was previously 2 hours, I believe, per party. That is now going to be extended to 3. So there's a little more time that's given, I guess, to accommodate the little more seriousness between $100,000 and $200,000. I'll come back to some practical tips in a moment regarding that. But there's also another hour that's added there. The trial and pretrial procedures are also changed, and everyone who is involved in these types of claims is going to have to be aware of these things and to diary their files accordingly. The pretrial conference is to be scheduled within 180 days of the action being set down for trial, so within 6 months. Previously, the parties were given 45 days notice in advance of the pretrial conference, so that is a substantial change as well. expert evidence is still allowed, obviously. You still have to comply with Rule 53.03. What is a big change here is the court's trying to free up time because of the timeline of a five-day trial. I'll get back to that in a moment, by having experts brought into the court by way of an affidavit. So you will see in these changes once forwarded to you that expert reports that have been served under Rule 53.03 have to be appended to an affidavit of the expert, in which the expert simply adopts the report for the purpose of giving their evidence at the trial. That will be, in essence, the examination in chief of that expert. 30 days prior to the scheduled pretrial conference, the parties that are involved in these simplified rules under the new monetary jurisdiction have to get together and work together for a trial management plan. So that will be something that will be mentioned quite a bit. I'm sure will eventually be referred to as a TMP. It has to be agreed upon by all the parties 30 days in advance of the pretrial. That plan, and you'll see this from the regulation, has to include a list of every witness and an outline of how much time each party will take to examine witnesses and to present opening statements and argument at the end. So I think we're familiar with some aspects of that, depending on the jurisdiction. A lot of the pretrials we go to require that kind of information, but now it is a part of a formalized trial management plan that has to be agreed to at least 30 days before the pretrial. Going a little bit further from that timeline, once you're 5 days prior to the pretrial conference, the parties must file the proposed trial management plan. In addition to that proposed plan, there has to be a copy of the affidavit of documents of each party included, copies of any expert affidavits, which would obviously annex the actual Rule 53 reports, and copies of any documents that are going to be relied upon for the party's claim or defense. So there's going to be a lot of front-end work going into a pretrial so that essentially the entire case is before the pretrial judge. To be used during that process. And that is a part, again, of that trial management plan. Additionally, so going back to the actual pretrial memorandum, as we used to call it, at the same timeline, within 5 days of the pretrial, they're referring to it as a statement of the parties, in addition to everything that I just said had to be filed. That statement is not to exceed 3 pages, and it simply sets out the issues and the party's position. That has to be filed with the court as well. So that will replace a pretrial memorandum. Moving forward towards the actual pretrial, the judge that ultimately will have the case before them, or the case management master if that is the case, has to fix, and this is in addition to a typical pretrial where there's going to be discussion on the issues. Excuse me. They're going to have to fix the number of witnesses for each party, fix the dates for the delivery of any witness affidavits. Those would be witnesses outside of the experts, lay witnesses and the sort, which they're also looking to put in as evidence at the trial. Fix the date for the trial at that pretrial, and most importantly, going back to the trial management plan, they're going to have to go through that and approve it. The judge really... he's in a position or she's in a position to vary those times that are provided by counsel. If they disagree with any evidence as taking longer or shorter, they're in a position to vary that, but they're still subject to this requirement, which is another substantial change under this regulation, that the trial will not exceed 5 days. So while they can change some items of the trial management plan, there's going to be limitations in the sense that they cannot exceed that timeline. So, again, moving forward from that point, essentially at that point, if it's not resolved because of the pretrial process, you now have before the court a document that has essentially all the evidence, subject to some more affidavit evidence coming in, but all experts are already there. The trial management plan is in place, and it's just a matter of getting it to the trial to deal with the evidence in the procedure that is now before us on Rule 76. So Again, trials are restricted to a total length of 5 days. But having said that, they're still entitled to opening statements, adducing the evidence by affidavit, cross-examination of witnesses if they're adverse in interest, assuming those parties intend to do so, a re-examination of witnesses that had been cross-examined, making of oral argument, and if the judge provides relief in this regard, reply evidence in terms of the case. So the procedure is still very similar, but it's obviously the consideration that has to be taken in place is time. It's all about managing that time and making sure that the trial proceeds within those 5 days and is completed within that timeline. So, you know, that's really the procedure, and then you are waiting for a verdict from the judge. It is a substantial change. The way that I see this change occurring is probably no different than my thoughts back in 2010. It really comes down to the stakeholders who are involved in issuing claims and whether or not those stakeholders are going to issue claims limiting the recovery to $200,000 or less. I have no doubt there's many, many cases where that makes complete sense. We can think of many property damage type claims where that is the amount. We can think of a number of commercial claims where obviously there's a very specific amount that is being claimed on behalf of the plaintiff as opposed to something to have to be assessed down the line. So it really comes down to from my perspective to the plaintiffs and whether or not they'll use it. It's going to be important, obviously, with instructions. I'm thinking of plaintiffs attending at plaintiff's office or plaintiff counsel's office looking to retain a lawyer. They're still not working. They don't know what their future holds for them, and it's right at the eve of a limitation period. Are they going to be in a position to make that determination at that time? I think that will be very difficult for a lot of players, but we'll have to see how that plays out. Another very important part of that is the actual limitation on the disbursement. So if you think about the rates for various plaintiffs' counsel, as I sit here, I'm looking at a pile of 5 expert reports that were just served upon me that I'm sure just those 5 exceed that $25,000. So the lawyers that are going to be involved in these procedures are going to be limited to recovery on behalf of their parties on the disbursement side. So that clearly is also going to interfere or change the perspective as it relates to how many experts, how much it costs to retain those experts, keeping in mind that may be able to avoid some of that expense depending on whether or not they're required to attend at the simplified rules trial, really coming down to whether or not the opposing party has an interest in cross-examining that person. So I do think that that's going to influence the number of experts that will be involved in this procedure, and I'm sure that was very intentional on the part of the rule changers. This definitely has some potential to reduce some backlog of cases where the value of the claim is under $200,000, but again, it requires those stakeholders to make that determination to proceed under that that amount. There has to be some motivation on the part of the plaintiff counsel to limit their claims brought by their clients, and I can think from a practical perspective, some plaintiff's counsel will be interested in doing that on cases where they do think there would be concerns in proceeding before a jury, who I think can be a little harsher than a judge, compared to a judge alone trial, with a judge also knowing that there's a statutory deductible if we're talking about a car accident case. But having said that, I do think there is potential here. If these cases are advanced within that jurisdiction, we will have matters moving expeditiously, hopefully not lengths of time from pretrial to trial of multiple years because of the changes relating to what's required before pretrial, despite the Rule 53 rules, is that you are ready to go to trial the moment you walk into a pretrial room, and the judge essentially has all evidence or expected evidence at that stage. I think that that's important to move matters forward. And if that is the case and everyone has exactly what they need stepping into a pretrial, then clearly the trials can happen very quickly thereafter. Resources and the availability of a trial judge within this procedure is to be determined. But it definitely has the ability to reduce some backlog that I'm sure all of us are dealing with. It's the availability or lack of availability of a jury trial that I ultimately think will be the big question mark for the lawyers that are advancing these claims. So just a couple of pointers that I had. I think that everyone that's involved in these Rule 76 claims are going to have to be aware of these changes. Insurer clients that are involved with their lawyers will have to understand that there's going to be a change as it relates to the discovery process. I mean, that's already the case under the current Rule 76, but just as a refresher, 3 hours seems like a long period of time, but to get all the answers you want within that timeline is not necessarily the case because it is a relatively short period of time. Again, thinking about various plaintiffs and what they are in demeanor, you have individuals that have difficulties providing their evidence, interpreters and whatnot. So it makes the process of productions even more important going into the examination for discovery process to make sure that you have as much information as possible that can be gleaned from the productions by way of the affidavit of documents so that the examinations for discovery can be very targeted and dealt with within that timeline. So everyone should be ready to deal with that. I also think it's important to note that there's going to be some very front-end exposure in terms of getting costs incurred on files because of what is necessary going into the pretrial process. There's going to be expense budgets going in for pretrial or up to the date of pretrial that I think will be much more substantial than we're used to because of the need to deal with affidavits, have every document you're going to rely upon at the trial, a full list of witnesses and length of time, all of the things that are going to be necessary, which usually is dealt with further down the line. So I think that there will be more, basically the trial prep comes into play before the pretrial, subject to some lay witness affidavits that you might get between the date of the pretrial and the trial. But you still will know who you're going to be calling by way of that management plan. So everyone should be ready for that and know the timelines in order to ensure that everything is before the court getting into that pretrial process, because I think that pretrial process and the plan that is agreed to by the judge is going to be very fixed, the idea being they want everyone ready and understanding how this trial is going to proceed at that session so that everyone is on the same page. So I do think that for subrogated claims, this is going to be a great opportunity. I mean, you've got subrogated claims that clearly up to $200,000 that encompasses a lot of subrogated type claims. I think that definitely will be of advantage to them and not dealing with juries. Finally, you know, this jury notice, again, is the significant change to see defendants taken away that right to have a jury. Again, keeping in mind the results that we have seen on some of these personal injury type files is really the crux of this change. It shortens things up. An obvious query will be what are the judges going to do with these claims versus what a jury would have done. And that's the same old discussion we've always had, but in this case here, the jury is simply not available, so you're not making that decision. It's made for you. So it'll come down to the judges and how they're going to approach the cases, at least that I deal with, and how they'll deal with the damages and threshold if dealing with an auto case, given this change. So I do think that this is substantial. It's upon us. It's going to be with us within a matter of a couple of weeks. Everyone should be ready for that change because I anticipate, subject to what I said about plaintiffs deciding to sue within that range, those will probably start to come in within the first month and having to deal with those timelines. So that's a general overview of the changes that are expected. There may be some questions that have come in as I talked for the last 25 minutes, and if so, I'm happy to assist any way I can.
Thanks, Rick. Yvonne, do we have any questions in the queue?
We do not have any question in the queue, but as a reminder, you may queue up to ask a question by pressing the number 01. And if you would like to withdraw a question, you can always press the pound sign. Thank you. Oh, we do have one question here that just queued up.
All right.
And, yeah, so great. So the first question is from Paul Lee. Please go ahead.
Okay. What's the sanction penalty if you have an award less than $200,000 and are not in a simplified procedure?
Yeah, so that's a good question. Thank you for that, Mr. Lee. I mean, really, there hasn't been any change in terms of the there has always been a cost provision within Rule 76 in cases where people bring claims under the regular procedure but ultimately are awarded amounts within that procedure. And that procedure, subject to the change from 100 to 200, is still in place. And, you know, I can refer it. You'll get my memo in a little bit following the conference. But the rule, I'm just flipping through here, it's 76.131. There, you'll see that there have been some amendments, but it doesn't really change the idea. The idea under the rule is that the plaintiff is supposed to be denied costs. And it really comes down to whether or not it was reasonable for them to have started the procedure within the ordinary procedure. And you know, I'm aware of some various cases over the years dealing with that, but my experience so far is that teeth that people do plead all the time in the ordinary procedure really hasn't resulted in cost awards that are consistent with the sanction.
Just to add to Mr. Lee's question and point then, Rick, do you think the cap on costs and disbursements are really going to be enforced by judges? I mean, you talked about the fact that the current trend is such that plaintiffs are getting these nominal verdicts and they're getting these huge cost awards. So do you think judges will use their discretion either way?
Well, they're bound to it. I mean, at the end of the day, the simplified rule that we're going to be dealing with come January 1 is it is maxed out, $50,000, $25,000 for disbursements. So if you incurred more, well, you do that at your own peril.
Great. Any other questions, Yvonne?
Yeah, we do have two more questions.
All right.
The next question is from Mark Katzman from Katzman Willipec LLP. Please go ahead.
Hi, I'm inquiring about the effect of Rule 49. Will it still play a role in terms of settlement offers coming back and forth between the defendant and the plaintiff? And will the new Rule 76 with the cap of $50,000 simply be that in that an award perhaps on a substantial indemnity basis that is more than 50 either for the defendant or the plaintiff would be just reduced to 50?
Well, I mean, going back to the Rule 49, I'm not aware of any real change. At the end of the day, you're entitled to deliver offers in accordance with the rule under Rule 76, and the judge has an opportunity to apply Rule 49 to the ultimate verdict. Because a Rule 49, in terms of the cost, it's really about what's offered on the indemnity side that has to be taken into consideration compared with the verdict in that regard.
Okay.
So I'm not aware of any change in that regard.
Thank you.
And I think we had another in the queue.
Yeah, that's right. So the next question is from Justin and Katie from Aviva Oakville. Please go ahead.
Hi, Rick. Just to clarify, the three-hour time limit for discoveries, is that per party or in aggregate?
You know, as I was going through the discussion, my understanding, let me just see if I can find it here. As I was presenting it, I may have said per party, and let me just have a quick glance here. I may have to send you a quick note just to save time. But when I send out the paper, I'll clarify that. in the actual paper, because the paper that I put together actually just spoke to the hours and didn't indicate party versus in totality. So let me do that in the paper when I send it out.
Perfect. Thank you.
And Rick, another question from the Peanut Gallery over here. What do you think about jury notices that were filed prior to January 1st, 2020, and in parties that bring motions to move the matter into the simplified procedure? Do you think those jury notices will stand, or do you think a judge will say you're over here and no jury?
I'm sorry, is that Serena?
That's me.
Hi, Serena. Okay, so, yeah, I mean, I've heard, not in my practice, but I've heard through the grapevine, that there are counsel for plaintiffs already with existing claims in the ordinary procedure who are bringing motions at this stage for return dates post January 1st, 2020, asking to amend their statement of claim to limit their claim to $200,000 and then try to get a jury trial, or non-jury trial. The provisions, and you'll see this when you see the regulation that I forward, speaks to, there's a transition provision. It's 76.14, and it speaks to various amendments and changes that you're dealing with under this rule change as not applying if a jury notice was delivered before January 1st, 2020. So I'm not really sure where those motions are going to go if it's actually argued, given that the transition period provision says you are entitled to your jury notice if you file one before. I suppose in theory, although I would think that plaintiff counsels that are doing that are aware they have a problem on their files before a jury, because they've probably gotten to a stage in their litigation where they know there's an issue, and are hoping that perhaps the counsel who represents the interests of the defendant will consider just consenting to that, to maybe try to limit the exposure to their insurance. I don't know. But in the same vein, I would think that if that is the case, that the defense lawyer is going to want their jury in that case and not consent. So it really comes down to the party who's presented with that request making a decision if they want to limit the claim to $200,000 and have no jury, or keep it at the ordinary procedure and get their jury. There's obviously a reason one way or another they would want to do that.
Right. That was great. Thank you. Yvonne, do we have any other questions in the queue?
Yes, we do have one more question here. The next question is from David Sampieri from RSA. Please go ahead.
I just have a question in regards to, like, a two-part question. Like, under the new rules, there's going to be no circumstances where a judgment will come in above the $200,000. The only reason why is I don't want a situation where plaintiff counsel may want to try to use the simplified procedure rules to get a high on a claim that's supposed to be above that, and that a judge will, let's say it's capped at 200, but they say, you know what, we'll give you a judgment of 300. So the 200 is kind of the maximum line that can happen. So it's a trade-off for plaintiff counsel in that regard. And then second part of my question is, can defendants, if they don't believe that these timelines can be met in terms of things, like I'm thinking of situations where you could have multiple defendants with where there could be some teeth to a claim that's under $200,000, but there are multiple defendants that may need to go to trial, you know, to sort out the liability, for instance, and it may not meet that 5 days. Can defendants file motions to bring a file out of the simplified procedure and go into ordinary rules with a jury, per se?
Okay, so let me start with number one. I mean, at the end of the day, the cap is the cap. So the absolute maximum that can be awarded under this rule is the cap of $200,000.
Okay.
So I think that's a simple answer to that. I'm trying to picture the situation you were just referring to. You may have a very complex liability circumstance that perhaps is requiring a lengthy period of time despite what is being claimed. Is that the question?
Yeah, I mean, there could be claims where, let's say, a claim is worth $100,000, but you could have a fight between two or three defendants in a multiple vehicle collision where they just can't agree on on, like, liability, who's at fault, you know, who's what percentage is going to play. And you may need, like, a lengthy, maybe a trust. Sometimes those trials alone can take their own, like, what, 3 or 4 days just to sort that out.
Yeah, and that is probably very true. I'm thinking of cases that I've been involved with a trial where that is the circumstance, and yes, those can take long. I think that I'm not aware, to answer the question, I'm not aware that there's any sort of ability of the judge to change anything to do with the limit on the trial. So that's what the language from the new rule is that he can vary the timelines that are proposed by the parties when they submit that plan to the pretrial judge, but he cannot exceed that 5 days. So the parties will have to work within that timeline to try to deal with that circumstance. If you have, you know, everybody has their own expert and you have lay witnesses that have to go in, you know, what the court has tried to do or what they've tried to do with this rule change is to deal with those circumstances by minimizing the actual court time that's necessary by putting the expert evidence by way of affidavit and also right. The lay witnesses. So while if you were full-blown with an expert going into the stand, giving examination in chief evidence, doing cross-examination, re-examination, and then you have lay witnesses coming in on the same circumstances, that's going to be a problem. But what the rule changes have tried to accommodate is that problem by having affidavit evidence to shorten the process. So,
I see.
So I'm not aware that there would be any ability to expand beyond those 5 days, and you have to manage your file in a way to make sure that you meet those timelines.
Okay, then just a quick question into the to just a quick thing, but there's no avenue for, let's say, a defendant in the action to file a motion to move the file out of simplified procedure.
If it's claimed within $200,000, subject to the exceptions that I gave earlier, it stays there.
Okay, that's all I want to know. Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Yvonne, another question in the queue?
There are no questions at the moment, but as a reminder, you may queue up to ask a question by pressing the number 01. Thank you.
Maybe we'll just hold for a moment, and while we do that, Rick, who do you really think is going to benefit from these changes? Do you think it'll be plaintiffs, or do you think it'll be defendants?
Well,
you're laughing.
I think, you know, going back to the grapevine story that I just gave, if for whatever reason those plaintiffs are able to get it into a judge alone circumstance, I think those plaintiffs are going to be better off in a judge alone in the simplified rules.
Yeah.
You know, the reality is, I think that the juries are harsher in their verdicts than judges. But judges, you know, these are individuals who have lots of practical experience. The hope is that they decide cases on the very same merits that a jury would, but that's to be determined. But I know that if I was a plaintiff in the circumstance that, wait, this is going to be a significant problem in front of a jury that may not be in front of a judge alone, I'm going to want it in front of a judge to increase the chance of my success.
Right. Last call. Yvonne, any other questions?
Yeah, we have two more questions.
Great.
Yeah, so the first one is from Zoran Samak from McFadden. Samak, please go ahead.
Hi, Rick. I might have missed the beginning. Is PJI included in the 200, or is it 200 plus PJI?
Zoran, that is a phenomenal question. And hello to you, too. I do not have that in front of me, but I vaguely remember that back in the day when the changes were made, that was a topic of actual decisions. So let me again look into that before I provide an answer. I'd be lying if I told you I knew the answer to that.
Okay,
I'll put it in the paper.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we do have a second question here from Justin and Katie from Aviva Oakville. Please go ahead.
Hi, guys. I just wanted to inquire, have they made any announcements if there's going to be any changes to the appeal process for any decisions that are made in these types of trials?
I have not been made aware of any change of the appeal process.
I haven't heard either. second last call. Yvonne, any other questions?
There are no more questions.
Okay, well, if there are any questions, please feel free to email myself, Rick, or Mary. We'd be happy to answer any further questions that anyone has. Look out for the paper from Rick, and I'd like to take the opportunity now to say thank you to you all. Thank you to CDL. Thank you to our operator, Yvonne. And last but not least, thank you to Mr. O'Coin.
Yes, thanks everyone from me as well.
Thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. This concludes the new changes to Rule 76 conference call. Thank you for your participation and have a nice day.